We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about some of the difficulties that arise from the fact that for most people in this country, certainly a lot of people in this country, their health care is tied to their job. Rising costs have made it increasingly difficult for employers to provide health benefits to their workers, both current and former. Some retirees, for example, have seen their benefits reduced or cut altogether. And current employees have seen their health care choices shrink as both the private and public sectors struggle to cut costs. In this hour of the show, our guest is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. He is an internationally recognized expert on U.S. tax policy. He developed one of the first law school courses on elder law, which is a specialty that deals with the legal implications of extended life. He's written and done research on Social Security, on financing for long-term care, on health care financing for retirees and current workers. And we're pleased that he could be here with us on the show to talk a little bit about this issue. In part, we wanted to have him here because state workers here in the state of Illinois have just been through a very unsettling, confusing, anxiety-producing period where they were told they would have to make changes in their health care and that they would have fewer choices than they had before. We're at intermission here in this whole process. We really don't know how it's going to develop, and we can't, of course, we cannot predict how it will develop. But the hope is that maybe after having spent some time talking with Professor Kaplan, the backstory here might be just a little bit more clear. At least we might understand not so much where we're going, but perhaps how we got here to this point. And questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you certainly are welcome to do that. And the address is will-talk at illinois.edu. Will-talk at illinois.edu. And thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
See, I take a day off and suddenly I've forgotten everything. I'm really glad that you could be here. And I'm expecting that things will be more clear at the end of the hour than they are now. And one of the things, as we were talking here beforehand, that really struck me as I was looking at a paper that you had written on this subject, a paper that begins talking about how employees of the state of Illinois were told that they would have to change their health care and that an option they had wouldn't be available, that an awful lot of people were affected, that people were unhappy because that they thought it would mean that they would lose their relationships with doctors that they would had for a long time, and that there was a great deal of confusion and people were unhappy. Then I look more closely at this paper and I realized that this paper was one that you wrote in 2005, which says we've been here before. And further, the thing that you write in this paper is that it's not an accident that we get at this point. That it was the intention that this kind of thing happened. So how do we understand this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This whole connection, as you indicated in the setup, about health insurance being tied to employment is rather unique in the developed world. Most countries with our degree of sophistication have health insurance as a right of citizenship. In this country, we've tied it to employment. That was never a deliberate, well-considered decision. It actually started in World War II when some employers were wanting to provide raises to their workers because workers were at a shortage due to the war effort. And because of wartime controls on wages and prices, they suggested perhaps they could provide health insurance as an additional compensation without running afoul of the wage and price controls. The Wage and Price Administration said that was okay because at the time, health insurance was not all that expensive, mainly because medical care was not as expensive. And when the question came to the IRS says, well, since it's really not all that much, we don't think the employee has to pay tax on it. That was the origin of what then was codified by Congress in 1954 and solidified this linkage between health insurance and a person's job. There are definitely some advantages to linking them, not the least of which is you're part of a large group and people with various health conditions are accepted, while if they went on an individual basis, they might not be able to get a policy or it'd be much more expensive. But there are some genuine downsides, and one of the most significant ones is the one that you just mentioned, namely that the employer makes the most critical decisions about what offerings will be available, what the plan will look like, what the deductibles will be. All of the negotiation of the elements is done between the insurers and the employer. And so the vignette that I began that article that you just quoted was actually occurred in this town in 2004 when it turned out that then Carle Clinic was dropped from the list, not because there were complaints, but because the employer had put out for bid how much health insurance should be costing to the employer. And Carle came in higher than the state of Illinois in 2004 wanted to pay. As a result, the state said then they are no longer an acceptable provider. This is how the system is supposed to work in the sense of they set it out for competition. The employer says to the various insurers, give me your best bid, and I will pick the one that is cheapest for me, the employer. And if that means that certain providers will be dropped, that's to be an incentive for them to come back with a lower bid the next year. Now, that particular episode had a happy resolution, but the idea that employers are negotiating for the lowest cost to themselves is a central element of this created nexus between health insurance and employment. One of the consequences is then that employees have their choices restricted. In fact, referring to our own situation, as severe as it was, and it was bizarre last week as most employees were getting multiple emails a day, all of which said urgent notice, many of which reversed what the prior notice had indicated, we were actually in better shape than most private sector employees. The majority of private sector employees do not have a choice. That is, their employer decides that this year we're going to go with XYZ Medical Group because they came in with the lowest bid, and that is the health care option. If people want to drop out of that and go get health insurance on their own, that's their prerogative, but the employer doesn't contribute to it at all. And what that means is that everybody in that employment group will be switching to a different provider, and the possibility is that that arrangement will be reversed the very next year. So the continuity of care that people were concerned about over the past couple of weeks is an element that is frequently lost when employers have complete control over how many options will be provided, what those options will consist of, and what prices will be available to the employees.
Hmm. Well, it makes it sound as if that the kind of situation that we see periodically, this is if it's still a matter of employers providing health care, and you can't fault them, I suppose, for wanting to control costs. They have to be concerned with what the out-of-pocket costs are. So for them, the bottom line is, what does this cost us? If all these things don't change, then this kind of situation where periodically there might be this big upheaval and either a worker may said, well, you were going here, but now you're going to go over here. Or in the case with the state workers, we said, well, you were going here, but now you're going to have your choice. You may have choices over here, but you can't go where you were going before. It sounds as if the basic idea here doesn't change, that basically it's healthcare is attached to your job, this is not going to change, and we should expect periodically to go through this kind of thing.
Actually, David, not only are you right, but it happens all the time in smaller groups that they don't get the same degree of publicity. But the idea that the employer is either dropping coverage or increasing the deductible, increasing the co-payments, or simply cutting out a whole range of providers happens every day across this country, and that is how the system is designed. If the employers are going to have any credibility in negotiating with various provider groups, they have to be able to say, if you don't come in with an acceptable bid, we will not offer your plan at all. And so that is what motivates the providers to come in with their best offer or the lowest cost that they can survive with. And the reason that works is because employers on a daily basis literally cut out certain options for those employees. So the state has been doing this occasionally, but for most employers, this is an annual event.
Now, I think if the state, is it every 5 years?
This time they're trying to go for a 10-year contract. Yeah, okay. And that's also actually what raises the stakes. If this were just a one-year thing, people would still be upset and they would still have their continuity of care compromised. Mm-hmm. But when it says that these will be the providers and we're not going to look back at this for another decade, that raises the stakes quite a bit. But there's no doubt that this phenomenon of employees having to change who their providers are is a significantly unique aspect of the American workplace. Literally, a woman can begin a pregnancy with one set of providers and be told in midstream that she's going to switch, not because she wanted to, but because the employer has chosen a different group. And the particularly pernicious aspect of this is that employees don't even have the option in most situations of paying more to stay with the old group. The state of Illinois employees had, of course, the option to go with, for example, Quality Care. It would have been much more expensive, but they at least could have had some insurance coverage for whomever they chose. Most situations, that's not the case at all.
Mm-hmm. So it does have, for as unsettling as this was for state employees, they still, their situation is still better than, it sounds, it's better than for people who work in the private sector.
That's definitely true, and the area where that is even clearest is with respect to retirees. Mm-hmm. That is, retiree health benefits is an area that is among the very first that employers try to reduce the cost of, because those people, by definition, are not even showing up for work anymore. And while they may have been promised certain benefits, they may have even been specifically offered benefits in order for them to retire prematurely or earlier than some other date. A long article I did in the Yale Journal of Health Policy indicated that employers across the private sector and even with unionized arrangements are reducing retiree health benefits, and when employees go to court, they typically get no relief because this is not covered by ERISA or any other statutory protection. In addition, many employers are saying that we want to get out of the health insurance business entirely. Namely, it's a sort of historical accident from World War II that they were in this business of securing health insurance benefits. They typically don't get a lot of credit for doing a good job, and many of them would like to simply offload that obligation. Interestingly enough, the Patient Protection and Affordability Act, the health care reform legislation enacted last year, which has been the focus of the McKinsey study that was on the lead-in to our program, has been a major issue whether employers will now really rethink this whole idea of providing health insurance and will simply say, why don't we simply allow our employees to go get the insurance on their own? Historically, that has been an unappealing option because individual employees may not be able to get the health insurance because of their pre-existing conditions or would have to pay an enormous sum. But starting in 2014, which is not that far away, there are intended to be these state-run insurance exchanges, and many employers are looking at these saying, well, now they will not be shortchanging employees in the sense that every employee will be able to buy health insurance on their own with whatever particular package of benefits that the individuals want. So single people may not want to buy coverage for pregnancy. And married people may not want to buy coverages for other aspects. They can tailor what they want. And retirees will probably be the first group that is essentially offloaded to these insurance exchanges. The mathematics of it actually work out even more so in that favor, where the employers may say if they cancel coverage, they will owe a penalty. But the penalty is a maximum typically of $2,000 per person. Most health insurance costs for an employer far exceeds that. And so if they just want to run the numbers, they will be better off paying the penalty, perhaps even paying an additional compensation to the employee so they can have some money to go with themselves into the exchange and get out of the health insurance business entirely. Most employers right now, particularly of larger groups, are not inclined to do that. But there is definitely going to be some economic pressure, and it's the analogy that is sometimes used is the penguins on the iceberg, who wants to be the first one to dive off. And once some respectable employers say, here's a $4,000 voucher or whatever, we're out of this business, there could well be a cascade of similarly situated employers who do the same thing.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. He's an expert on taxation and tax policy, and this whole business of healthcare financing, also something that he's done a lot of thinking and writing about. We're talking about some of the issues that arise from the fact that for a lot of people in the United States, their healthcare is attached to their job. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And the address for the email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So if you'd like to send us your comments that way, you certainly may do that. And we have some people here on the phone, and Champagne is up first. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
It's my understanding that Carl restricts what insurer their doctors can go with, and I'd like for you to discuss a little bit how that complicates things and whether it's not a big problem that Carl refuses to let its doctors go become involved in some of their insurance groups.
I'm really not too familiar with the details of their particular arrangements, but this is fairly typical that they restrict their providers from negotiating with different groups, and the state of Illinois knew that, and that was part of the negotiation that Carl could, of course, sign on to particular options. But part of the arrangement is with the managed care setups that we have in this country that if you want to be part, if you want to get services from a particular group, you are restricting your access to a group of providers. If people have a problem with that, and particularly as some Americans get older, they want to have the freedom to literally go anywhere, then the indemnity plans like Quality Care or the open access plans become more attractive. But the least cost to both employees and employers is to go with either a managed care organization or some kind of group that says, this is our group of providers. You cannot get care from them unless you're part of our group, and when you can only get care from our group. So that's how they can control costs. If anything, the health care reform legislation, through a development that is still on the boards but has been legislatively authorized, something called accountable care organizations, is trying to move people into coordinated care. That is, doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, pharmacies are all supposed to be working together, and that they are to be a vertically integrated group, not available to outside participation. That's what gives them the organization the ability to control cost, to therefore come up with the lowest possible bid, and that's how the system is supposed to work. Now, you notice the missing element in that process is the benefit to the employee, the patient. And there,
yeah,
the main benefit is that they would presumably have lower cost. And there's definitely a conflict between access to care and the range of services and providers that one can have and the cost. For people who preference or think it's more important that they be able to see any doctor, then they will typically go for a higher cost option. But the restrictive covenants, the particular arrangements that you're alluding to, are fairly typical with managed care organizations because that is how they can come up with a fixed price and basically take the risk of who knows what sort of developments will occur to their covered patients. And then they can take the risk and say to the state of Illinois as an employer, well, we're willing to say, here's how much you pay, and we will manage it, the cost, internally. But from the employee standpoint, other than the initial cost, there's not a whole lot of benefit. In a sense, this is just another example of the conflict I talked about at the beginning, that when the employers are in charge of health insurance, then they make all of the front-end decisions about what the plan will look like. That is, how many options will there be? Will there be a managed care option? Will there be a high deductible, co-payments, et cetera? While the insurance exchange concept that is part of Obama's health care reform, it says, no, let there be a thousand flowers blooming, or at least a various range of options, and let individual employees or patients pick among them. So there's definitely a conflict, and it's one of the downsides of tying health insurance to employment, namely that the employers control the design. I don't want to indicate that that's the only such conflict, probably the one that we haven't spent much time talking about in this program, but is a huge issue for Americans in this recession, is that when people lose their jobs, they also lose their health insurance. And while we sort of take that for granted, that's not the case in other countries, where you lose your job, you're obviously going to have less income, but at least you have your health insurance. At this point, unless people will pay for very expensive continuation coverage, one of the other downsides which the Obama health care legislation was intended to address was to break this linkage, so that when people lose their job, they're definitely going to lose some income, but it doesn't cascade into a full-blown financial crisis as they lose their health insurance without the ability to pay those bills.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to Effingham next, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, two things. System is so corrupt that it can't function. If people were paid across the board of any venue a living wage, that living wage would be $50 an hour, which you could buy your health care and all those things that go along with living under capitalism. But that's never going to happen. The other thing is, my wife recently got a prescription, which the pharmaceutical companies have no binding obligation nor price control. She bought a little tube of salve, not 3 inches long. Of course, the health care that we have helped with it, but the initial price for that medication was $710. And who is it with no job, no prospects, a small job, $8 an hour, can even think about anything except that they are somehow viewed as subhuman? Thank you.
Yeah, there's several good points there. Certainly, as the gentleman indicated, the cost of health care has gone up enormously. That's why the original decision from 1943, when the IRS said, well, health care doesn't cost that much, it can be included, and we're not going to include it as taxable income. In retrospect, that seems just bizarre. But at the time, you didn't have tubes of medicine costing $700. There weren't procedures for a lot of things. Healthcare wasn't necessarily as good as it is today. A lot of illnesses were essentially death sentences. A lot of chronic diseases were just a predictable spiral to death. Now these things are managed, and people continue to live full lives. There's a cost to that. It's a substantial cost, and in fact, the more cutting-edge the treatment, the newer the pharmaceutical medication, the higher the cost will be. So the idea of trying to pay out of pocket is really not feasible. And that's why health insurance has become much more indispensable than it was in 1943, as well as much more expensive. The gentleman's first point also is an interesting issue about it would be perhaps better for people to simply get higher wages. And in fact, many of people's raises that they would otherwise get are being gobbled up by the cost of health insurance, so that by having health insurance be part of what people get at work, they may think of this as a freebie, or it's frequently called a fringe benefit, but no, it is a part of the compensation package. That's why employers are able to deduct the cost of the health insurance, just as they deduct wages. The difference is the wages are reportable and we pay tax on them. The health insurance is not. Therefore, people have a very clear incentive to ask the employers for as comprehensive a health insurance policy as can be. That, yes, it'll raise the cost, but they're basically trading off higher wages for more comprehensive health insurance. And since the higher wages would be subject to federal income tax, state income tax, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, they're actually better off taking a lower wage and having more comprehensive health insurance. That assumes, of course, that they'll be using the health insurance. But in making that assumption, most people opt for more comprehensive health insurance at a cost of lower wages. And until we break that linkage and say the full amount of wages is going to reflect what people's labor is worth, and if they want health insurance, they will go and buy it and it will get as comprehensive a policy as they want. Until we break that linkage, we're going to have this anomaly where people are seeing that their nominal raises are disappearing because the employer says, well, I did pay you 8% more this year. You just didn't see it in your paycheck. It went to the cost of more expensive health insurance. Yeah.
Well, given the fact that there has been that linkage for some time, and given the fact that there seem to be at least Congress, a lot of resistance to the idea of some kind of government-financed health care system. It seems that the medical community is actually starting to come around on that. But given the fact that there's a lot of resistance to making the change, do you think that change is ever going to happen?
Well, that's a great question, and I left my crystal ball in the car. But you're quite right that this idea of delinking health insurance and employment is starting to get traction. In fact, in 2008, in the presidential campaign, Senator McCain actually made this proposal that health insurance be included in taxable income. That wasn't going as far as what you suggested, that is, not even have the employer provide it, mm-hmm. but at least it was going to make people sensitive to the cost. Now, then Senator Obama went after Senator McCain extensively on that issue and made some serious headway attacking it. So people were not too keen on the idea of reporting their health insurance as income. Mm-hmm. At the same time, this is a favorite proposal for both health reformers who think that Americans might be more prudent spenders if they saw the cost, and tax reformers who, in a totally different but parallel universe, say this is one of the most expensive so-called tax expenditures, that is, revenue leakages. In fact, when you make a list of all of the provisions in the tax code by which the federal government fails to collect revenue, not illegally, I'm not suggesting that, but deliberately, this is number one. And so the Bush tax reform panel of 2005 actually did a thought experiment, said, what if we kept the entire tax code the way it is, but just made this one change, which is that include the value of health insurance provided by an employer in the employee's income. So you still have the employers providing it, but we recognize it. Then that would bring in so much revenue that you could literally lower tax rates across the board by 5%. So people who pay 28% now would pay 23%. People who pay 25% would pay 20%. So we are all paying for it indirectly via higher tax rates. And so tax reformers for literally 30 years have been suggesting that this is a way of flattening the tax schedule, having lower rates by including more things in the base. Healthcare reformers have said for a very different reason they also would like to see this change. You're quite right that it faces tremendous political resistance, but the Obama healthcare legislation actually took a bite in this direction, mm-hmm. starting in the year 2018 for so-called Cadillac healthcare plans. These are the very expensive, very comprehensive plans, which says that after 2008, that the value of certain health insurance plans above a certain cost will be included in people's taxable income. Not directly, but the employer will pay an excise tax. So this was a baby step. It might be a mini baby step, but at least they broached the idea that this once sacred cow should at least be discussed.
I guess in this hour focus is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. We're talking about some of the implications of the fact that for most people in this country, at least for a lot of people in this country, that their health care is tied to their job. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here throughout the week with different topics every day. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about immigration, and we have two guests that look at it in a little bit different way. Tyke Hendricks is a journalist, and she's written a very interesting book about the issues along the border between the United States and Mexico, and her making the argument that, in fact, this is a very dynamic place with people who have ties to both sides, and it's very difficult to draw a very clear line. Also, Peter Schrag will be with us. He's a journalist, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley, and has authored a book that takes a look at how people over time in this country have thought about immigration. And it essentially makes the argument that some of the things that people have said about immigration, some of the things they're saying today, are the same things that they have said before. Then also one other show I want to mention tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. We'll again talk about immigration and maybe make some comparisons between how the United States, how we're dealing with the issue, and how Europe is dealing with the issue. And our guest there will be Terry Givens, Associate Professor of Government at University of Texas, Austin. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. If you have questions, you can always call in. If you'd like to see the schedule or listen to past programs, go to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. And our guest in this hour is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois in the College of Law. He is an expert on tax policy and has been with us before to talk about Social Security. He's interested in that. He's also done a lot of writing on things like the problem of long-term care and how those costs are taken care of. And also the subject we're talking about here this morning, that is healthcare in this country and what it means that so many people have their health insurance attached to their employment. We have several callers here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call, and we'll go back here to the phones next, line 2, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello?
Yes. Yeah. I have not made any effort to change anything that I have because it's satisfactory to me. Do I need to do anything? I don't want to pick when I'm happy with what I have.
Yeah, I'm not really in a position to give specific advice to people because you need to know a great deal more than I think you want to reveal
on the air. I just want to know, do I need to change anything if I want to just go the way I am?
Not at the present time. You may want to check with the benefits office, but at the present time, if you're happy with what you have, then everything is held in steady state for the next 90 days. Though, as our host David Inge indicated at the beginning, this is not really a resolution of the issue. It's a 90-day postponement. So sometime around end of August and for the first part of September, we're probably going to see a replay. And by then, it'll be a brand new ballgame. That is, the various options that are available, that have been available up till now and that are continuing for the next 90 days. Some of them may be available, some of them are not. So this has been a period when you are fine to just stay where you are for the next 90 days, but basically we're going to have to see what's going on after that time. And then everyone, not just you, but even people who want to make change, people who don't want to make change, will have to reevaluate the situation because the whole idea of the 90-day period was to resolve various court challenges and see which options are going to be available and under what conditions. So right now, you need not do anything, but starting about the first part of September, presumably there will be a great deal of information because the state is still taking the position that it will save substantial sums with the restricted choices that it offered, and yet some of the providers are trying to challenge that. The purpose of the 90 days is also to give some of the providers a second opportunity, perhaps, to make some changes to sign up with particular arrangements. And so it will be either similar or very different starting around September 17th, and that would be the time to check with the benefits office to see which of the existing options are still available.
Okay, one more question. My health care and everything is partially from a retired university employee. The rest of it is through my husband, ex-husband's, late husband in Social Security. Am I tied in a funny way here?
Not necessarily, but if you're over 65, and I wouldn't presume to establish that just based on phone call, then people are entitled to Medicare. whether they worked in the compensated workforce on their own or through an ex-spouse if their marriage lasted at least 10 years or through a current spouse. And typically, Medicare then becomes the primary payer, and what the state plan will be will either be supplementary to Medicare or will be a so-called Medicare managed care arrangement. Those things have been available in the past. Exactly what the format will be really remains, but it doesn't matter whether one is entitled to them on the basis of one's own employment or through an ex-spouse, at least once one reaches the age of 65.
Well, I'm over that, so I can just sort of sit back and wait and see what they tell me.
Well, we're all going to be in that situation.
I guess.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And just also we'll remind people, just to make things that much more confusing, that the legislature did pass a law saying that for a period of 2 years, nothing would change, and also changing the mechanism by which the state bids out the contracts. It has gone to the governor. I don't recall having read anything. The governor has not said anything. His spokesperson has not said anything about whether the governor will or will not sign that. If he did, then it would be rather moot for at least a couple of years. But I think your point, and it would not surprise me that the state government would still stick by their assertion that this will lower health care costs and it's something that they have to do.
No, that's exactly right. There were actually some rumblings in the early part of June. Everything was sort of third-party hearsay, but it indicated that Governor Quinn was going to veto that bill. Mm-hmm. You're quite right that the two-year extension would leave everything copacetic, in place, no changes. The state revenue people, though, were opposing that bill because they said then there's no savings to be had. And that is, of course, their proposition, that the state will save a lot of money if they go with the restricted offerings. The two-year thing was basically just to get them over another election cycle. But because it was Governor Quinn's administration that came up with the budget savings, and he's looking to find budget savings wherever possible, I think there's some credibility to the rumor, and that's all it is, that he's planning to veto that. Yeah. You're quite correct. If he were to sign the bill, then this issue becomes moot for at least 2 years. But then, of course, they will need to find some other way to save money on the budget. In addition, it's not purely a strict budgetary issue. There's also the notion of a state with as many employee and retirees as they have should be in a different risk posture. This starts to get a little technical about whether they should be in open access plans. And the fact is that 96% of employers with groups nearly as about as large as the state of Illinois are into the open access and away from the managed care plan. So the thought was that the state of Illinois ought to be in that avenue anyway. And so even if it were to cost more money, but they figure that it's going to save more money. But you're quite right that probably the among the other things that retirees and employees have to keep their eye on over the next couple months is whether Governor Quinn signs that legislation, which did pass both houses of the legislature, because if he does, then the question is over. If he does veto it, they may have an option in October to override that veto, which then gets into high-stakes chicken because the 90-day period ends September 17th, and so people will be compelled to make some decision, which then may be completely nullified if the legislature were to override that veto.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's go next to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Could you explain the difference between an HMO and an open access plan?
Certainly. They're both differences at the level of employees and at the level of the employer. I'll make the assumption that you're not interested as much as to what effect that it has on the employer, but we can certainly talk about that later. The HMO is a much more comprehensive kind of arrangement whereby you are restricted pretty much to the providers, the physicians, the hospitals, the nursing homes, the pharmacies, the home health care agencies that are part of that group. If people go outside the group, then usually there is no coverage at all. That is, you're paying the full cost. If it's an emergency and people are out of town, then they may get some coverage. Each group is a little bit different. If people are not in the immediate geographic area, oftentimes they have what they call network providers, which you still pay more otherwise than you would locally, but you're getting most of the benefits. But the main point is that the health managed organization, the HMO, is a one-stop solution. And the indisputable benefit is that it eliminates virtually all paperwork. That is, you pay a monthly charge, and there may be some co-payments, but they're very minimal. And the rest of it is all prepaid, in effect. On the other hand, you can go to only the people who are listed on their roster. The open access plan is a kind of mid-range solution between the HMO, which says we will cover most services, but you have to use our people, and the so-called indemnity plans, of which Blue Cross is the most famous, which says you can use, and for that matter, Medicare is basically an indemnity plan. You can go to any provider in the United States. You don't have to know whether he or she or it is part of any kind of group, and we will pay 80% or whatever it is of the cost, and you pay the other 20%, but you pick, it's the ultimate in choice of providers. The open access is a compromise between those two groups, and so they will typically have a number of tiers. And tier one, basically, this is our restricted group. That's essentially the same as an HMO, but the difference is if you go outside that to tier two, then you have a broader range of providers that you can use, and you'll be paying some additional cost, more than you would with the tier one, but it's not as much of a cost as you would with a complete indemnity plan where you can go anywhere. So to use some numbers, typically if one were to go to a doctor, then in an HMO, you may have a small copay of $5, $15, something like that, and that would be the end of it. With a open access plan, you would have that with tier one, but tier two would probably be you'd pay 10% of the bill in addition. And in an indemnity plan, then you can see anybody, but you're going to be paying 20%. And it's not just 10 versus 20%. It's also that there may be no special rate that has been negotiated as there would be by both an HMO or an open access plan. So probably one of the main questions to sit down and think about is you make a list at the current time of the providers that you see regularly, internists, other specialists, cardiologists, eye doctors, so forth, gynecologists. Where are they now? If they're part of the a group that is in tier one of the open access plan or in the HMO, then people are going to be inclined towards that arrangement. If they're all over the map, if some of them are in Chicago and some of them are in Rochester, then you're not going to find a plan that's going to include them, in which case the indemnity plan like Blue Cross or Quality Care in the state of Illinois is going to be more appealing. And so it is, of course, as is the case with all insurance, a bet on the future. But the best people can do is take a look at who they utilize currently and make a guess that the future will resemble the past.
Why did Carl go to the court because of OAPs?
Now, that's a great question, and that would be best answered by somebody at Carl. I would imagine just by reading the newspapers, anyone else does that.
I've read them all.
what Carl found, specifically Health Alliance, is that they were not included in the range of options at all. And so they wanted to be included, and therefore that's why they wanted to basically renegotiate the arrangement or at least say stop this process from going forward. Now, many of their enrollees may have stayed with them as part of the quality care arrangement, but it would have been much more expensive. But they were also, I think, legitimately concerned that some of their enrollees, particularly some of the lower utilization types, may have figured, oh, I might as well go to another HMO or at least an open access plan. And since Carl wasn't among the choices, they would be losing those people. And that's why they wanted to basically have a do-over. And since the state agency wasn't permitting a do-over, they needed to go to court to try to stop the process from going forward. The real interesting question is, why did they not do some of that negotiation and give and take before the final decision? And they would be the only ones to really be able to provide that behind-the-scene discussion.
And why would the judge have decided to stop it, because the open access plan?
That's probably more legalese than you want to get into in this program. There was a question whether a due process had been followed and whether the specific procedures of the procurement process had been followed. Now, obviously, the procurement agency thought they had done everything by the book. And in fact, the university, when it does procurement for things much smaller than health insurance, is supposed to give a certain amount of weight to price. And they may, and that's a minimum. So they may have thought that, no, we followed the procedure that the legislature laid out. Now, if the legislature doesn't like the result, it is, of course, the prerogative of the state legislature to change the weighting system and the procurement process. But the state agency apparently felt, no, we followed what you set out. If you don't like the results, don't give us grief. Change the process. But the court apparently had a different opinion. Keep in mind that the court's opinion may well be overturned on appeal. So I don't want to suggest that it was the correct assessment either. But by throwing that particular monkey wrench into the process so close to the deadline, that's why I think the state felt that they weren't going to find an appellate decision before June 17th, and that's why they had to do this emergency 90-day stay-as-you-are contracts to sort that out. But I think one of the things, that one of the parallel tracks that the state is proceeding on right now is to try to get that judge's opinion overruled, in which case we're back to where we were. This is, you might say, comparable to three-level chess.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clarified several things.
Very good. We'll try and get at least one more caller here in Philo. This is line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question for you. It's not about any specific insurance problem. I have a mother who is in the nursing home, and it's not really about her either. But one thing, I've been around the medical system for a couple of years, and one of the things that really floors me is how nobody knows how much anything costs. I mean, if you ask anybody how much something costs, they don't know, because they expect the insurance company or Medicare or something to pay the bill, and that's it. Nobody knows how much anything costs.
Now, that's a central problem with healthcare in America, in the sense that this was probably one of the prevailing issues raised last year when healthcare reform was front and center. Namely, that the government, as the payer of a huge amount of American health care costs through Medicare and Medicaid, is concerned about the cost, but no one knows the cost of individual procedures, in part because they're not paying, or they're paying a fixed amount of copayment, and they don't have enough skin in the game, as the expression goes, to worry about it. As long as you're going to have third-party payers, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or whoever it's going to be, then people tend to become less sensitive, and it's the people who, to the cost, it's the people who have no health insurance at all who are paying for it out of pocket, then they are the most concerned. Same kind of thing when we go to have our car serviced. Since we're paying the full cost, we ask up front, and the car dealership can tell us up front because we're the ones paying. Health insurance perhaps needs to be bifurcated so that routine procedures have that kind of cost sensitivity, while when you get to things like major operations, that's going to be so far beyond what people could handle. That's probably the best role for insurance rather than the regular checkups.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, we'll go one more. Spring Bay, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. A couple of summers ago, they were having those meetings about health insurance, and I attended one, and a doctor stood up and spoke eloquently about how this current legislation would be a stopgap, and that we would eventually need to go to a single payer as the only way that this would work. And I was wondering if you had an opinion on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Now, that's a great question. People are becoming more and more frustrated with these insurance arrangements, and It's not just the individual patients, it's the physicians I speak to as well, that they would just like to have one system so they can focus on health care. That was considered by President Clinton back in 1993, and the assessment then was that America was not in the mood for it. If anything, I think that assessment would be even stronger today, and the whole debate that's going on right now and that animates much of the Tea Party about the individual mandate is very much contrary to the notion that we are all in this together, that there should be one universal health care system for us. That may yet happen, but under the current political alignment, I would think that's highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point here we're going to have to finish. Now, this is, as we said, this is a story that has yet to be completed. So we really don't know what's going to happen here. All we know is that things, in a sense, are on hold for 3 months until this temporary 90-day period passes, and then people might again be in a position to having to make a choice. We don't know what the governor will do. Don't know what the legislature will do. I think actually that things, to me, seem a little bit more clear. I said at the beginning, we'll see if we can make them more clear. What sort of idea, though, would you like to leave with people?
No, I think you're absolutely right that people really need to pay close attention for the next 90 days. As you said, there are several parallel tracks that judge's opinion might get overturned. The governor might sign the two-year keep everything as it is legislation. The contracts may be completely renegotiated. This is very unsettling because this is not some trivial fringe benefit. This is a huge part of people's compensation, and it's probably one of the most intimate aspects of their employment. And this, what we've seen from the Obama health care legislation is we're going to see more of this as everyone, employers and employees alike, adjust to the new world of employee benefits, and people are going to become much more expert in areas that they would just as soon leave to others.
We'll continue to try to follow. For the moment, we'll say thanks very much to our guest, Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. We appreciate
it. Thank you, David.
It.